So welcome to another edition of the Media Twits. I'm Mark Glazer, executive editor of PBS Media Shift, and joining me from New York is Rafat Ali. How are you doing?
Hey, Mark. How are you doing?
Good.
I guess we're coming after a little bit of a break.
Yeah, it's been good to have some time off for the holiday, for Thanksgiving, and to just kind of take stock and thank everyone that's been good in our lives and take
a
break.
Yeah, and you have a lot to thank for in the last six eight months.
I thank my kidney donor, my fiance Renee, by taking her on a trip to Santa Fe. So that was fun.
Nice. And I may have to take you up on some advice on that one, because we're thinking of doing a road trip.
Yeah, it's pretty fascinating place, and I have a new addiction. I'm probably the last person to become addicted to Instagram now.
Really? No, I am left.
You still haven't? Oh my God!
I am left. I think you are the second last person. Yes.
I don't know why I was avoiding it, but I love filters, so it's like you could take
using
a picture.
The filters? I don't think you're my friend anymore.
Well, the thing is, I mean, it's, yeah, I have mixed feelings about filters, but I've always had fun. I mean, even when I took film shots, I was actually attaching filters to them for fun. But this like push button filtering is so much fun.
Yeah, I think, I mean, it's still growing like crazy. They just launched a web version of it, which, did we talk? We haven't talked about it because we haven't, it only launched in the last 2-3 weeks.
Yeah, and then you probably saw Facebook has taken some privacy heat for saying they're basically going to connect Instagram to Facebook better, which I actually think, in a way, it would be a good thing. I mean, one thing I notice about Instagram is, you know, it'd be better if it was integrated a little bit better.
Yeah. I mean, I think it'll be that some hue and cry like Facebook always has when it does something major. But in the end of the day, users will, I mean, for better or for worse, primarily for worse, will just get used to it.
Yeah. And I mean, I always think that when they make an announcement and it's Wednesday night before Thanksgiving, you always question it and wonder if they're being, you know, the most upfront about it.
Yeah. The one thing I'm hearing more and more and more, just because we have looked at Facebook marketing and stuff, one of the things, and this is a whole separate topic we can talk at some point, but there's increasing buzz that Facebook marketing is useless, or the advertising is useless on it. And there are a bunch of studies that have come out in the last 2 months, month and a half, 2 months, that have criticized it. Just this whole year has been the talk about Facebook marketing not working.
Yeah, I mean, one thing I did notice in being on kind of mobile Facebook a lot is that, and I know my fiance Renee sees this because she's a huge Facebook user, but she started seeing ads like popping up every status update.
Yeah, so my wife and I both saw it this week. I actually tweeted it as well on a weekend, this weekend. We started seeing the same thing.
Yeah, and I mean, that's a huge change. I mean, I know when Twitter started doing that, it was a little bit kind of strange, or, you know, it kind of takes you by surprise. And same thing with Facebook, to say, you know, it's basically like, oh, you know, you should like this page, check out this page. And it's like, well, wait, it's not my friend liked this page. This is just a page that I'm assuming should be relevant to you and your likes, but sometimes it looks a little random.
Yeah, it's doing some games. So now it's actually not even directly just doing the likes. What they're doing is, even the one that I got was from Marriott hotels, and it sort of kind of makes sense, I guess, because I'm writing a lot about travel, or stuff on my wall is a lot about travel, and it says install now. So it's the app, it's the iPhone app for Marriott that's being advertised through the Facebook app.
But I mean there's also a lot of news breaking as far as now Jeff Zucker, the former head of NBC Universal, or NBC, is now going to be the head of CNN, and that had been rumored for a while. And we'll see where that takes CNN. And then also there's been this news about Yahoo and Marissa Mayer. She seems like she's getting a lot of buzz for what she's doing, bringing in some top names. And I guess now moving away from the media business and how that might affect AOL.
Yeah, it's just, it's been a fact. I mean, it's been, even though the holiday season, the news has just been unbelievable, the amount of news. and the Zucker CNN thing, which a lot of the people love to hate him. And a lot of people love to hate CNN too. So I guess it's a merger of two right brands right there.
Definitely. And so the big news we're going to be looking at on our podcast beyond just those headlines is the Leveson inquiry into the UK phone hacking scandal basically came out today on Thursday as we're taping the show earlier in the UK. And has, you know, Leveson kind of came out and called for a very strong kind of independent regulatory body for the media there, possibly with some statutes and some legislation behind it. The question is whether, you know, this is bringing kind of a new regime of kind of press regulation in the UK, you know, what will happen next. We'll have Tristan Stewart Robertson, our man in the UK, reporting on that. And then we'll also talk about a new mashup of Instagram and Google Earth called The Beat from the Rutgers social media folks at the Social Media Information Lab. And we'll have them come on and talk about a really neat kind of visual mashup that, you know, like everything else, makes us question kind of the privacy aspects behind it. So we'll talk to them. So first we'll look at possible regulation coming to the UK press. After 9 months, Lord Justin Leveson released a nearly 2,000-page report saying that the British press has had a systemic problem with ethics and breaking the law. He said the best way forward was for the press to set up an independent group to monitor it, possibly with a law or new legislation backing it. The Prime Minister Cameron said that there should be no more laws restricting the press, but what will happen next? Joining us is Tristan Stewart Robertson, freelance writer based in Glasgow, Scotland, who's done some work for News International papers such as the News of the World and the Sun. He contributes to PBS Media Shift on issues around the United Kingdom. Welcome, Tristan.
Thank you.
So I know you've been paging through the full 2,000-page report, which is pretty much very difficult for a lot of people to handle there.
I've only started on the summary so far. The 2,000-page report may be my Christmas reading.
So what's your take on the findings? I know we're seeing a lot. There's a whole live blog at The Guardian just looking at everyone's reaction to it. It seems like people are kind of all over the map with kind of instant reactions. What's your take just on kind of first blush?
That it was a report that should have been done 20 years ago. You mentioned the live blog at The Guardian. In the summary, I did a quick search before I came on. In the 56-page summary, the word blog only appears once. And Leveson was very clear in his opening remarks when the report was released this afternoon that he said, quote, "What the press do and say is no ordinary exercise in free speech. It operates very differently from blogs on the internet and other social media such as Twitter." And I mean, Emily Bell, who is former Guardian herself, she had written, I think today or yesterday, that, again, that it's not recognizing what the press actually is now. And I think that the report is both broad in blaming everyone and in saying that the press is all guilty of all these horrible things, but also being too narrow in focusing only on newspapers when that world is far broader than it used to be 20 years ago. So it doesn't take into account that you can be a reporter just using Twitter, and that none of the suggestions in that seem to address that you could be operating in a digital world independently as a reporter, independent of a newspaper. And that wouldn't be, I'm not sure actually from reading it, whether or not you would be under the same remit as a newspaper in whatever legislation form there may be coming.
Well, isn't it better to not be under it?
Well, see, you're coming to it from a perspective from the US, and that's one of the interesting things is that the suggestion has been that this legal underpinning would be like an American First Amendment.
Oh, okay.
Which it would not be, because I've reread the First Amendment. I'm Canadian, so I don't have it memorized off the top of my head. But that is a very broad and simple fundamental of the Constitution. What they're suggesting is a piece of legislation. And that's what I took David Cameron's concern as, that a piece of legislation is not the kind of ironclad freedom of speech of a First Amendment. It is something that can be changed. It's something that can be amended by politicians. And you've got two very different approaches. Leveson, at the end of his presentation, said the ball is clearly in the political court, or the court of the politicians. And Cameron said the ball is clearly in the court of reporters and the press.
Now, Nick Davies at The Guardian had his reaction, and he was talking about what he thought was Leveson's way of saying, okay, this isn't about necessarily regulation as much as it's kind of an independent self-regulation. In other words, he's talking about this kind of independent body that would be independent from the press, independent from politicians, and operate as this kind of third party, but set up by the press themselves. So it sounds like a very complicated instrument, and it's hard to understand exactly how it would operate.
Well, yeah, and I think the starting point, the PCC is flawed. It's got to be redone, probably from scratch. The Press Complaints Commission, the self-regulation body that failed to stop the bad practices and didn't really address the problems that were repeatedly brought forward during the inquiry. So that, yes, can clearly end. You need something that is independent. And actually reading through some of the suggestions, like having a board that does not have media on it, so something that is independent of those proprietors and independent of politicians, is, you know, that's having an independent resolution system for disputes with the press is a pretty sensible thing. The problem is when you then apply legislation to it, the way that I'm reading it at the moment, and as I said, I haven't read all 2,000 pages, is that if a newspaper were to not sign up to that legislatory framework or that independent regulator, then it would be brought under the remit of Ofcom, which is currently the regulator for broadcast media. And then I'm a bit unclear as to what kind of control that means. And it still doesn't obviously apply to blogs. I mean, we don't have the same kind of experiments or ideas with internet and blogs and news websites that the U.S. has yet, because the newspapers are so powerful. But that is coming. You know, the Guardian has a digital first policy. The Scotsman newspaper recently went digital first. That is eventually going to become the dominant area. So what do you do for those organizations if they someday don't have a print edition? Are they no longer part of that framework?
And what about, what will happen next? I mean, there's a lot of people kind of taking divergent points of view. And I mean, the government is kind of left in this strange quandary. I know the Independent has this article about David Cameron, the Prime Minister, and just how he's created this monster, and now he's kind of in a no-win situation, because if he just ignores the Leveson, you know, conclusion, then he'll look bad, and if he takes everything at face value, then he'll look bad, and if he compromises, he'll look bad.
Yeah, I mean, there is the suggestion that, you know, we have to, I can't remember now who said this, but if we don't, I think it was one of the politicians in reaction to Cameron today said, you know, if we don't do something, we'll have another Millie Dowler. And there's no question that there were victims of certain illegal activities. Phone hacking was already illegal well before any kind of press law or investigation. So there's no question that there were victims of a small number of reporters. But using that as an argument for creating something that regulates the entire system of the press without clearly defining what you mean by the press and who is a reporter and who isn't, and you know, what part of regulation is valid and what part isn't, is incredibly complicated. And yeah, he might be in a no-win situation. He's definitely in a conflict because his coalition partners appear to be in favor of the legislation, as do the opposition.
And you're talking about tabloids too. And so, you know, can you really legislate the kind of the way that these kind of tabloids operate? And then when you think about, okay, let's say you do legislate and you do get this stronger self-regulation for some of the tabloid papers, well, then you've got things like TMZ and all these online operations that, you know, really don't have a whole lot of ethics or standards when it comes to these things. I mean, then what happens to the online realm? I mean, would that just push tabloids into new and different mediums?
Well, I mean, if you were an online, you know, if a British star is in Hollywood, for example, then TMZ can chase after them perfectly easily. And that content can then go back and be accessed in Britain from online. And there's nothing that can be done about that within a British legislatory or regulatory framework. So there is kind of that's why I say my gut reaction is it's a report that's 20 years too late.
Because it's an isolation of all the stuff that's happening. I mean, I bet already Daily Mail and Telegraph to some extent, of course, Guardian has done a bunch moving their operations, not moving the operations, but part of their operations, or some, they're establishing major operations in the US. And if it's, I mean, what would it would, nothing would prevent them from just increasing that. I mean, if it's just a matter of putting servers here and putting all the operational stuff here, they'll do it.
I mean, I'm not clear as to whether or not the location of server, you know, how that will actually affect the law. I mean, I am a reporter based in Scotland. I have a news website that has servers in Iceland, particularly for their press freedom theories. But I have, you know, I still am working in this country, so I am bound by those professional standards, which I am part of as a member of my union and as a member of the papers that I do work for, and all that sort of thing. So there is not that world where there are set borders that are clearly defined.
Well, thanks a lot. I really appreciate your quick response on this.
No, I remember us talking about this 18 months ago when it started. So,
yeah, definitely. I mean, it was like, it really was like this week in Rupert Murdoch, you know, everything related to Rupert. And it doesn't seem like he's really come up about this at all.
No, and I mean, they got off. I would say one of my colleagues said to me today, I'm so tired of defending what I do for a living. And there are so many, there are thousands of good reporters who are a bit tarnished by this report, unfortunately. But we continue to do the job that we love to do. And I hope that there is some recognition of that, whatever comes next.
Okay. Yeah, makes sense. Well, thanks a lot. I appreciate you joining us.
Thank you very much.
So next we'll talk about The Beat, which is a mashup of Instagram and Google Earth. The mashup comes from the Rutgers Social Media Information Lab and combines Instagram images juxtaposed with their location on Google Earth. It gives context and depth to what you see on both services, but also raises some privacy concerns. BetaBeat headlined its story as Mug Me. So does The Beat go too far? Joining us is Morna Amin, who is co-founder and CTO of Mahaya, a platform to organize the social media generated in all the world's events. He's an assistant professor currently on leave at the Rutgers University School of Communication and Information, where he runs the Social Media Information Lab. Welcome, Moore.
Thank you.
We also have Abe Stanway, who's a software engineer at Etsy. Previously, he studied philosophy and computer science at Rutgers. He tweets at Abe Stanway and writes love letters to the internet at Abe is a blogger. Welcome, Abe.
Nice to be here.
So Moore, tell me about this project, The Beat. What was kind of the mission behind this? What were you guys trying to do with that?
Right. So there's probably a lot of background. Let me give you the short version. We believe that social media is increasingly telling the world stories, and everything that happens is reflected in social media. The Beat is part of the project that's funded by the National Science Foundation and other organizations, and it's much bigger than the app that you're seeing right now. Our goal is to learn about society from the social media information, so we can learn about language, about relationships, about our culture, and in this context, we want to learn about cities and urban environments. So I've been interested in social in location information since my PhD, and we're now swimming in this kind of location, in this kind of content, from Twitter, from Instagram, from Flickr, Foursquare, many other platforms. And we can start addressing these big questions like, for example, how is New York City different than Boston? Do people go to sleep later in New York City? Actually, our data said they do. And what kind of people visit the Lower East Side on a weekend? And is Bryant Park better for hanging out than Union Square, and all the crazy stuff like that. And for something more practical, we asked whether we can use social media posted by individuals to create kind of a dashboard for a city. What is going on, what is unusual or important right now, and even something like, did New York already fully recovered from Sandy? So there are significant challenges in addressing all that. For example, the very scale of the data, the noise, and the bias that's built into these social systems. So we started with something simple, and the question is, what if we just provide a little more context around a single piece of media, like an Instagram photo? And it turns out that just adding the Google Street View was turned out to be quite interesting.
Yeah, and I mean, you're basically searching by hashtag on Instagram, and you can pull up. I mean, I saw some of these stories. They were looking at things like drunk dog or drunk mom, and I mean, they were pulling up some really funny stuff. So, I mean, more than just what, you can do in social research, I mean, you can actually be pretty entertained by this.
Absolutely. It definitely provides some entertainment. And it's, strangely addictive. I've been watching it myself, for a little bit and, seeing what kind of images go by. It's true. We're actually, I think there's entertainment. There's a sense of what's going on, especially if you type in a query that's related to something that's happening right now. You can see, you can get more context. I mean, we're not really showing any information that was not available anywhere else before, right? You can go to the Instagram app and see those photos as well, but we're just contextualizing it in a way and creating an experience around it in a way that just lets you, sit back and watch it. So I've been lucky to have worked on this with some of my star undergraduate students and some of the other students as well at Rutgers. So I think we built an experience that's quite compelling.
And Abe, tell us about your role in this project and what you kind of got out of it.
So I built the original iteration, and this was last year. And then I helped touch it up just for this launch recently. And in terms of architecture, it wasn't too technically challenging. The main problems we ran into is that it's Twitter and Instagram. Like, this was originally based on Twitter, right? So we would scrape hashtag tweets and get their Foursquare check-in photos as well as Instagram photos and Flickr as well. But the problem with using Twitter is the thing called rate limits. So the way we access data off Twitter is by using their API, which is a way for developers to programmatically get any services data behind it. So every app that you see that's built off a social platform uses their API. And Twitter is kind of notorious about rate limiting their API, and they're not really doing very good stuff towards the developer ecosystem. So we decided to not use Twitter and to solely focus on Instagram. But we've been running into some similar problems with Instagram as well. We've been hitting some rate limits, so we're kind of doing some things to get around that, which is not really the best thing to do in terms of being nice to them. But we're trying to get in touch with them, see if they can, for the time being, let us have more queries to the API to get more images.
I can see, because we're covering the travel sector from a news information perspective, a lot of it's interesting. Some of the inspiration sites that are startups that are out there, and some of the travel memory sites that are post travel kind of sites are trying to figure out ways to visualize images in context better. And it's an interesting, I think what you're doing is very interesting in that context for the travel industry, for sure. And for us on the back end, looking at the data and then trying to figure out some trends and what's trending and what's popular and where and how, from a news information perspective, is quite interesting to us too.
Yeah, so for the travel aspect, this is interesting. You know, this is goes back to something we've done back in 2007. I was then at Yahoo, and we were working with the Flickr folks. The Flickr people were the first, the Flickr service was the first place where a large amount of location-based content was available. And we then we had a system that automatically, you know, took all those dots on the map and automatically extracted the landmarks and the highlights in every single city and every region of the world. And then we also took the photos and we created an automatic summary of those photos that represented those highlights in the best way. So you can, you know, see obviously San Francisco will be the Golden Gate Bridge and you know, Dolores Park and Transamerica Tower and all these things you could expect. But you can dive further into the neighborhood level and learn more and more. And this is all just from, you know, people implicitly just putting their content out there and telling us what they paid attention to.
And can you talk a little bit about your startup, Mahaya? Because it seems like it's focused on kind of event-based things so that, you know, you can pull up an event, a concert, something that happened, and really see it through all the different kind of social media, right?
Yeah, exactly. So this is, I guess, leveraging the same kind of idea that the people are paying attention to something. And by paying attention, in our new world, that means that they're taking a photo, capturing a photo or tweet and sharing it with others. And in particular, this happens a lot in real-world events, whatever, if it's a conference or protest or a music event, anything that happens is increasingly represented in social media. So let's say something happened, maybe a music festival, 20,000 people went and tweeted and posted photos, and there is no place on the web right now to see all that information and to see what happened or that story. So in the startup, we, again, leverage the people's attention and the way they share, and we find, index, automatically organize and present this data in a new way. So this is both about what's happening right now, as well as going back in time to experience history in a new way. So let's say Hurricane Sandy again. Can we go back to the night of the hurricane hitting New York City and relive it through the eyes of the people that were there? Yes, we can. That's what we want to do.
And do you guys have any worries about this kind of, you know, what people are bringing up around stalking and, you know, the fact that, yeah, you might see something on Instagram, but seeing that also in Google Earth really gives you an idea of where they are at that time?
I don't really think so. Like these concerns have been around social media since their inception and their, you know, mainstream adoption. So, and again, this is all publicly available information. Like if you go to an Instagram photo and it's geotagged, it will tell you in Instagram. And in fact, it will actually show you the map too. So we're just kind of visualizing it in a different way. I really think those claims are unfounded. And if the people who originally shared the photos were actually concerned about stalking, they wouldn't have shared those photos on public channels in the first place.
Yeah, I think in a way, this Abe is making a great point, and we make the public. It was not our goal here to bring out privacy concerns. It's not like the MugMe project. But it also obviously raises awareness for people that haven't perhaps realized that they're exposing their location in this way. So I don't think we didn't create this as a you know, breaking privacy tool, and we're not adding any new information beyond what's already there for anyone to grab via many other systems. But for some reason, the juxtaposition of information there makes people think about that immediately. And I have to say, privacy is obviously very important, and we do not want to discourage people from posting their information with the content with location information, because we think it's useful. We think it's a useful way to see the world, to share information about the world, and we can use it in many different ways. And people do want to do that. They want to say, "I was here. I shared my photo of the Golden Gate Bridge." They probably want to think twice before they share photos from their own house. So I've been thinking about privacy almost as early as I started thinking about location. And at Yahoo, again, we built a system called Fire Eagle that was designed to help you share your location in a way you can control.
Okay, well, thanks a lot, guys. I appreciate you joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of The Media Twits. I'm Mark Glazer, executive editor of PBS Media Shift. I want to thank my co-host Rafat Ali, as well as our guests Tristan Stewart Robertson, Moor Naaman, and Abe Stanway. We want to thank PBS and the Knight Foundation for making this podcast possible. Be sure to keep up with all the news, polls, and events over at PBS Media Shift at pbs.org/mediashift and our sister site, Idealab, at pbs.org/idealab and our news site, Collaboration Central, at collaborationcentral.org. We'll catch you next week.